Tonight I want to talk a little bit more about where I'm from in the Southwest. But before I do that, and before I show the slides, which primarily feature things from the Southwest area of the United States, I wanted to read a quotation. This quotation is actually written by Coleridge, Samuel Coleridge. But it's taken from the context of Madeline L'Engle's book, Walking on Water, that I've recommended that people read in terms of reflections on faith and art, in the idea of what her definition of trying to figure out what it means to be a Christian artist, that this is one of the difficulties we face too as Native American people, in the sense of what does it mean if you get something that's Native American art or American Indian art. Do you only recognize if it has something traditional in it, some kind of traditional element? If it's made out of beads, does it automatically mean that it's Native American art? If it's painted on a drum, does that mean it's automatically Native American art? If it's pottery? But what happens if an Indian person paints a very modern-looking painting? What happens if an Indian artist happens to choose to work in gold rather than turquoise and silver? Does it stop being Indian art at that point? And this is a question that we get asked a lot and that we have to ask ourselves back home. But it's also a question that Madeline L'Engle asks about what it means to be a Christian artist. Is it only Christian art if it depicts something religious in nature? Is it only Christian art if it shows Christ or if it shows angels or something? And her response is no. That the very fact that you are Christian doing art makes it Christian art, regardless of what the subject is or what the medium is. And in the same way, a lot of people feel that it doesn't matter what the medium or the subject is, if it's a Native American person doing it, the values, the ideas, the beliefs that that person has makes it Native American art, regardless of what the expression is. And with that in mind, I want to quote something that Madeline L'Engle wrote, where she's quoting Samuel Coleridge. Coleridge writes, "The Jews would not willingly tread upon the smallest piece of paper in their way, but took it up, for possibly, said they, the name of God may be upon it. Though there was a little superstition in this, yet truly there is nothing but good religion in it, if we apply it to man. Trample not on any. There may be some work of grace there that thou knowest not of. The name of God may be written upon that soul thou treadest upon. It may be a soul that Christ thought so much of as to give his precious blood for it. Therefore, despise it not." This week, some attention has been paid to the idea of apartheid, particularly what's been going on in South Africa. A lot of American citizens don't realize that American Indian people did not become citizens of the United States until 1924. As a matter of fact, we just celebrated our anniversary of becoming citizens this month in June. My father was not born a citizen of the United States. Indian people became citizens of the United States in 1924, primarily because a number of guilt feelings as a result of World War I, where many Indian people gave their lives for a country that wasn't theirs, a country for which they were not a citizen. And so with that in mind, I'd like to show you some of the slides from the Southwest. Have to understand the Southwest in context. It's really part of a much larger circle. I talked on Monday about the idea of the sacredness of the circle as a symbol for most Native American people. And part of it is the idea of the circle having no beginning or no end. That a circle is a sense of wholeness, of completion. And so it is for a lot of our religious activities, our ceremonies, our rituals. We revolve around this idea of the circle, the idea that the food that we eat has been taken from living things. To the extent of the small ear of corn this young girl has, she's a Pueblo Indian girl, that corn gave up its life so that her life can continue. That the sheep that we eat, or the deer, or the other things, gives up its life so that we can continue. And to us, that's a terrible price to pay, because the Creator has taught us the most precious gift of all is life. And because of this, we feel an obligation to continue our religious ceremonies where we return in the form of energy or song or prayer a little bit back of the power that we take away by our consuming the lives of other things. In the 1920s, particularly, the federal government came down very hard on forbidding us our traditional ceremonies and activities. And this is a picture of a group of Pueblo leaders. The representative from my reservation is the man on your far left who's sitting down, who has his hair braided and wrapped in red wool, the way you often see me wear my hair. This is a group of representatives from the Pueblo villages who went before the American government because of the oppression that was going on in terms of our religious freedom, that the Bureau of Indian Affairs came down very hard on our activities. And they said that it was forbidden for us to practice these things because they felt they were the devil. And the only way that they felt that we would become civilized is to give up our religion, to give up our dances, our music, our language. And so all those things were forbidden. The religious activities, such as you see here, this is a kachina, or what we call in our language a kachina mask. It's worn in certain ceremonies and certain dances, particularly among the Pueblos and the Hopis. When a dancer is masked, wearing a mask such as this one, there's the idea that the dancer transubstantiates himself. The idea that in the old days it was said that the spirit people, the Chasina or Kachina, used to live on earth along with us. But the world changed in some way, and at that point the Kachina people came and they said, we will no longer live on this earth or this dimension, but we will teach you our songs and our dances. And when you wear these outfits, when you wear these sacred uniforms, these masks, we will be there with you in spirit. We will enter into your body so that as you dance, we will be there with you once again. And so these dances are very, very sacred. It's our belief that by doing these, that we can live in harmony with a very harsh desert environment, which doesn't have very much rain, has very little fertile soil, and yet provides us with a living as it has provided us for literally thousands of years. But it's a very delicate balance of existence. And so it was a great fear from the old leaders, our traditional religious people, that if we were to give those things up, we would literally die. We would cease to exist as a people. Our world would end. And so this was very special to us. The Indian people had gone out in the Southwest a few years before that in terms of getting some land returned. In the 1920s, the people that you saw a few minutes ago went out again and said, the American people came to our aid when it was proposed to take away our land. Will they not come to our aid now when it's proposed to take away our very souls? The religious dances, such as the one you're seeing here, which is a corn dance, were forbidden by the government. What they said in the 1920s was that you could dance, but you couldn't dance during certain months. And they named off all the months where the religious dances would be taking place. You'll see the dancers here are dressed in different traditional symbols and designs. There are parrot feathers on the top of the dancer's head, the red feathers closest to you. The parrot feathers represent the powers of the south associated with the spring, where after winter has begun to leave, the warm winds from spring will come up from the south, and we associate parrot feathers with being from the south since they were gotten in trade with Mexican Indians. They carry in their hands Douglas fir, which is a kind of evergreen which represents everlasting life. The seashells that he's wearing as a bandolier will click together. If you were listening to me last evening during Vespers when I was wearing a traditional outfit that had deer claws, deer hoofs, rather than the shells, as they struck together they make a kind of jingling or tinkling sound, and to us this represents the sound of falling rain. So it's important for you to realize that it's not just what we say as prayer, it's not just what we sing or we dance. Even the clothing that we wear is in itself a form of prayer. The shirt that I'm wearing right now, if you look at it when the lights come back on, the back design represents a rain cloud with rain falling down. So what I'm wearing is a visual prayer. Also, the seashells are associated with water. hence the association with the rain. We train our young people in terms of dancing, and yet the restrictions in the Bureau of Indian Affairs at that time stated that no one under the age of 50 was permitted to dance. The animal people are very important to us because they formed a tremendously vital part of our diet. And so a lot of our dances are called animal dances. This is the beginning of a buffalo dance, and the dancers are emerging from the kiva. A kiva is a Pueblo term that refers to a chamber. In our reservations, they're built underground. This particular one, I think, is in Santo Domingo, which is above ground. And the dancers will use that as their preparation place, where people will be initiated, where rehearsals for the religious dances will take place as meeting chambers. And these animals, they're the horned animals. It's called a buffalo dance, and yet it's not just buffaloes that dance, it's also the deer and the antelope, all the animals that have antlers. And it's the idea that we are dancing in terms of praise and thanksgiving for the gift of these animals that sacrifice themselves so that our life can continue. The deer dancers come down, and my reservation, well, I don't have pictures because it's considered sacrilegious to take photographs. In most of the reservations, this is true. A lot of the photographs that you'll see, like these that were taken in National Geographic, are not actually taken from the real dances themselves because that would be considered sacrilegious. It's taken from reenactments of the dances so that people will have an idea of what they look like. Photographs have been forbidden on most of the reservations in the Southwest since about 1918, 1920, when Indian people realized what those boxes were. In our reservation, the deer dancers will not dance with this stylized an outfit. They will actually take a tanned hide of the deer with the head still on it and antlers and dance with that, so that from the back they really do look like deers dancing on their hind legs. And these dances again show respect to the deer. In most of the pueblos, what takes place is that after the deer dancers have finished dancing, then the women will chase them. The deer dancers are men. And they will capture them and take them home to their own home, and they'll feed them there. And in exchange, again making the circle, the deer dancers will provide them with meat. In addition to the men who are dancing as the antlered people, the horned people, there are women that are chosen. It varies from village to village. In some village it's only one woman. In our village it's two women who are chosen. And these women are chosen because they embody or exemplify the highest qualities that we think of as women possessing or human people possessing. And they represent the Earth Mother, the spirit of the Earth herself. And so they will dance with these deer people and the buffalo people, antelope people. The belt that you see, the sash in the center with a long fringe, again the long fringe represents the fall of rain coming down as a visual sign of prayer. The dancing sticks are to represent the four legs of the deer. And you'll see another dancer is dancing alongside to represent a hunter in terms of looking for these deers. It's said as a kind of a belief that if a deer dancer is not captured and taken back home, then if the sun goes down before that takes place, then they'll turn magically into a real deer. So you don't want to be too hard to get. The other thing I wanted to talk about in the Southwest is how important it is for a lot of Indian people to recognize beauty in all things. The song that we sang at Vespers the other night was talking about beauty being all around you. And this is true in our traditional beliefs, that it's important for us to make beautiful things like the basket you see, not just in the idea that it's artistic or that we're going to sell it to a museum, but it's what we use not only for religious activities in terms of dances, such as this basket dance that's being done by a young woman, for the ritual purposes, but also the mundane purposes, the everyday tasks or chores of living with this woman where she's winnowing her grain. That even in some areas, such as this corn grinding stone, where it's not really decorated, that you're seeing it only as a snapshot, that if it were really being used by a person, there are corn songs that would be sung. Yahiu, 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 Haya, Eha, Ehaya, Eha, Ehaya, Yahiu, 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 Haya, Eha, Ehaya, Eha, Ehaya, Hu. So that the rhythm of the song keeps the work going easily. And so even though there's not a visual piece of art as you're grinding this corn, there's a musical expression, performance art, you might say. And so the idea of decorating, the idea of making beautiful, the idea of, I guess not so much making beautiful, but reflecting the beauty that's already there around you is very much a part of the healing. In the sand paintings that are done, the Navajos get most of the recognition or publicity in terms of doing sand paintings, but the Pueblos and Hopis were doing sand paintings long before the Navajos came into the Southwest Territory. That the paintings will often depict a legend or a story where someone who is in the process of being healed, who went through a similar experience in terms of illness to the character in the story, that as the character in the story goes through the process of being healed, of getting over the sickness, there's a belief that so too will the person hearing the story and undergoing the ceremony become healed in the same way as the protagonist in the story who's depicted in the sand painting. So again, even though a lot of people only see these as being decorative, the real source of them, the real use of them, is in a very sacred and a very healing way. In the true sand painting itself was destroyed when the sun goes down. So that even though it may take many, many hours and meticulous labor to construct something, it's done with the complete realization that it'll be destroyed with the completion of the ceremony. These sorts of sand paintings that you see on display have been changed in some significant way from the actual one that would be used in the ceremony, because if they didn't, again, it would be sacrilegious. These sand paintings are very important to the people. They embody different designs, they embody different concepts, they embody different values. If you look around, surrounding the four circles which represent the four different directions, there's something that bounders them, borders them. And this is a yay figure, yay shape. Yay in the Navajo language, or yay biche, means holy people or spirit person. And you'll often see them depicted in other forms of art, such as this rug, which is being woven, and their yay people being depicted. Oftentimes, the yay people will be surrounded by a rainbow, and this rainbow represents the messenger way, the pathway by which they follow and visit people on Earth. And just in terms of sexual equality, I wanted to again mention that even though we associate weaving in many cases with a woman's responsibilities, among the Pueblos and Hopis, it was traditionally the male role to do the weaving rather than the female role. Pottery was something that was done both by men and women, although certainly the women are associated a little bit more strongly with it than the men. Oftentimes, in the case of the most famous of the potters in the Pueblos, Maria Martinez, her husband was the one who actually did a lot of the decorating, that she was the one who actually constructed the pots and fired them, but he was the one who did a lot of the decorations on them, so it was a joint effort. The men were more associated with painting designs rather than the actual construction of the pot itself. As I mentioned the other night, Indian people traditionally have never used a potter's wheel, and even though it's certainly available to them now, it's considered something inappropriate for Indian people to do. So they still make them in the old traditional way of the coil construction. And again, these pots are something that mean a great deal to us, that Indian people so often use metaphor to teach. And part of the teaching is that we save the old pots that were made by our ancestors because they'll be broken. And we take those broken pieces and we'll grind them up. And if you work with pottery, you know that one of the techniques of making stronger pottery is to take clay that has already been fired and become hard and to break it down into small grain-like particles and put it into your new clay, and that gives additional strength to your new clay. And in the same way, our old people tell us or teach us that that's why we keep our traditions alive, that we take the wisdom and experience of our elders and we put it into our new clay, our children, so that they become stronger. And so our young people learn to listen to our elders and to respect them. That the different designs on the pottery share many different meanings. And as I was saying, the first evening, it's hard to say that one element means exactly this, because it'll vary from individual maker to maker, that some families will have unique designs that belong to them. Other things will be fairly standard family designs or tribal designs. If you look at the top of this particular piece of pottery, the design that borders the very top of it, it looks like kind of swirls. Those are actually two hooks coming together. And one of the traditional explanations is that those two hooks coming together represent the joining of male and female, for example, a marriage, or else friendship or companionship. But the idea of balance, that one doesn't dominate the other, that they're both equal in the way that they're presented, in the same way that as human beings, male and female people are equal. You'll see that design repeated in a number of the pieces of pottery, the three designs, the olas or water jars that are over to the far right. The different designs are made out of, the black is made out of a kind of bee weed, which is used and painted on using sticks of yucca. The red designs in the polychrome pottery that's on the far left is using red clay as watered down so it becomes a kind of a paint, and then painted on top of the white clay. Again, in the Southwest, there's the idea of how important our children are to us, how meaningful they are to us, how we have responsibility to them. In many of the Indian tribes, particularly in the Southwest, but also in most of the other Indian nations, children are not necessarily raised by their parents. That in most Indian tribes, we don't consider a person to really be a fully mature person, to be a true adult until they're in their mid-50s. That we don't consider anybody under the age of their mid-50s to be really patient enough or responsible enough to really handle responsibility. And so for that reason, child-rearing is given over to the grandparents' generation rather than the parents, so parenting always skips a generation. And it was something that very much confused Margaret Mead, who explored the Sioux Indian people and didn't understand what was going on, and made the statement that she couldn't understand why Sioux women made such lousy mothers but such incredibly good grandmothers. And part of the reason for this in terms of a grandparent age, as we see here working with a grandchild teaching Navajo history, is the idea too that we rear children more in terms of an extended family in a traditional way. And so that means that a parent is not the sole guiding force of a child's life. That a child, in terms of a family tree, would have all of their first cousins considered brothers or sisters, literally, in the language as well as the attitude about them. And that the first circle that would surround them in terms of nurturing care would be the grandparents, not only the father's parents, but also the mother's parents. So that in reality, the child ends up with two sets of major parents, but then also their own biological mother and father would be on the next circle out, would be a kind of a parent, and their aunts and uncles would also be a kind of a parent. And so in reality, a child might have six parents or eight parents or 10 parents. And as a family therapist, one of the things that we find in our research is that this is a lot more psychologically healthy for a child in case there's a death in the family, where a death of a parent can be so devastating to a non-Indian child, where you have a nuclear family, but in the extended family of traditional Indian networking, the loss of a parent is certainly felt, but it doesn't have as significant an impact on early childhood formations of difficulties that a nuclear family does in non-Indian society. And I wanted to end with this picture because it leads into something I want to talk a little bit more about tonight, and that's the idea of the clown. This is an old historic photograph because nowadays these photographs would no longer be permitted because, again, it would be considered sacrilegious. This is a picture of people who are called mudheads. The mudheads are a form of clown on the Zuni Reservation as well as Hopi and some of the other pueblos. The masks that they're wearing are made out of burlap, and then they're coated with red clay, so even though you can't see it in this black and white photograph, they're the color of the clay. So when they say that they're mudheads, that's pretty much what they look like. And they have this strange appearance because it's said that in the old days, in the beginning of creation, they were the first people who came out on this land. And in those days, in the Indian language, it was said that the world wasn't ripe. And so for that reason, things didn't have the hardness of form that they do now. They could shift and change into different things. And that's the way it is with these clowns, that they're not quite ripe, that they're not completely formed right now, that they could go in many different directions. And that's kind of the theme I want to talk about this evening. So if I could have the lights come back on. When you're working with the whole idea of clowns, I know that there is some interest in terms of some contemporary Christians with the idea of clown ministry. And I want to talk a little bit about what clowns mean to American Indian people. Clowns are very important. Most of the different tribal people had clowns, or still do. In our reservation, our tribe, clowns are called the Shifaneti. And the clowns have a very important job. One of the responsibilities that clowns have is that during our religious ceremonies, clowns will act as the policemen. So they'll be looking around for people, particularly non-Indian people, who have things like tape recorders or cameras. And people have been very specifically warned periodically during the day that no photographs are allowed during the ceremonies. And the clowns, if they find you with a camera, will first take your camera away. They will either destroy the camera or they will take the film out and destroy the film. And then they will pick you up bodily and throw you into the river that runs through the middle of our reservation. And it seems like every year, even though we tell people this is going to happen, a number of non-Indian people won't believe that it'll really happen to them. And so usually about 3 p.m. or so, you'll see this usually blonde streak of hair on its way to the river screaming. But this is the way that we reinforce or enforce what it is that's important to us. When the clowns come down, they start on the 5th floor of our pueblo. Our pueblo, if you don't know about pueblos are adobe homes that are stacked on top of each other. They're kind of the first condominium structure. And the clowns will start up on the 5th floor of the pueblo, and they will jump from one story to the next story down. So it doesn't take them very long to get down 5 stories. They must have really strong legs to do it. But you can watch them jump from rooftop to rooftop. They land on the ground, and they'll seek out people, and they'll look for the most respected people in the village, the clan elders, the tribal chief people, the cacique, who's the spiritual leader of the village. And they'll go behind them, and they'll make fun about the way that they walk, about the way that they dress. They'll mock them. They'll imitate them. They'll do it mercilessly. And part of that teaching is the idea that as human beings, we tend to take ourselves much too seriously. And when we take ourselves too seriously, then we put too much importance on ourselves. Now, there's a balance behind all this. Remember, I've been talking about balance each time I've been doing presentations, that one of the things that was talked about last night in Vespers was the whole idea of humility, that we need to be humble about ourselves. But a lot of people have gotten very confused about that word and actually interpret as meaning you need to be ashamed about yourself. And that's not what humility is about. Humility is a balance so that you don't go into too much self-importance, but you don't swing to the other extreme in terms of being ashamed of who you are. And that's something I've been talking about this week too, in the sense of what it means to be an artist, what it means to create, that a lot of people are ashamed to try to create something because they're not pleased with the results of it. I don't think God is always pleased with all the results that he gets in his creations, but it means that they're not finished yet. Okay? And in the same way, when you try to do your own creation, some of the things you do may not yet be finished. It doesn't mean that they're a bad creation. And so, don't be ashamed of who you are. Don't be ashamed of your gifts, even though you don't think they may not be as outstanding as other people's gifts. I also brought some books for you when you have a chance later on in the evening to look through. One is on general Native American designs, American Indian designs and decoration. And the other one is explanations from a Hopi man on membrace pottery. Membrace is very ancient pottery. The clowns are very important to us because they're sacred. And it's very hard for a lot of people to appreciate the sacredness with humor. That particularly in a lot of Christian churches, we associate that if you're very sacred, you should be very solemn. That you shouldn't laugh, that you shouldn't smile, because that would be showing disrespect. And yet for a lot of our traditions, that may be the time that you're showing the most respect. And a Kushiwasha. Long time ago, coyote was going along. Now in the Southwest, one of the differences between the many tribes is that in our Pueblo stories, we don't often talk just about coyote. We'll need to be specific and in our own language talk about blue-striped coyote or red coyote or yellow coyote, checkered coyote, that there are many, many different coyotes, not just one. Now, in the dances, as you were seeing on the slides, in many cases for the religious dances, it won't just be one person hopping around. It'll be a whole line of people dancing. And the people will rehearse for long periods of time before they actually do the final dance. And Coyote was going around, and he was on top of a mesa. And Coyote looked down, this old man Coyote, and he saw at the very bottom of the mesa, there were kachinas. And these kachinas were dancing. And he looked over from where they were rehearsing this dance, and he saw that they had brought food, and this is very traditional for kachinas, because after the kachinas finish dancing, they'll distribute food to all the people who have come to watch the dancing. And Coyote looked at this food and thought how wonderful it would be to steal that food so he'd have something to eat. But he was so high up on the mesa, he realized that by the time he climbed all the way down to steal the food, the kachinas would be finished. So he thought about what he could do and he got an idea. And he started howling and he called all of his relatives around, these yellow coyotes and blue coyotes and striped coyotes. And he said, "This is what we're going to do. This is my plan." And he said, "Everybody grab somebody else's tail and chomp down on it, and we'll form a chain of living coyotes. And so you hold on to my tail and lower me down, and then the next person grab that person's tail and lower that person down, until finally we'll reach down to the very bottom of the mesa and steal the kachina's food, and then we'll haul each other back up and we'll share all this food." So all the other coyotes thought this was a terrific idea. So they runned around, they chopped down on everybody else's tail, and they started lowering the coyotes down, this living chain of coyotes. And they got halfway down, and one of the coyotes farted. And one of the coyotes turned around and said, "Who farted?" And the minute he said, "Who farted?" he opened his mouth, and all the other coyotes fell. And that was the end of that mess of coyotes. Now, that's a traditional story that's told, that even though the kachinas are among the most sacred of all beings, that we still tell stories like that. And I think this is something you need to look at for your own self, to not to make yourself too unimportant and yet maintain that balance and that harmony so that you don't make yourself too important. Recognize that you have wonderful gifts from the Creator, even though you may not have discovered specifically what those gifts are or how to best use those gifts. But that doesn't mean they're not there. And a Kushiwasha. Long time ago, coyote was going along. Now in the Southwest, we like to tell a lot of coyote stories. In fact, people, whenever you talk about coyote, they'll start to smile because they know something silly is going to happen, or something funny, or especially something nasty. And this is something that's very hard for a lot of non-Indian people to understand, because our sex education took place in the form of these storytellings. That if we didn't have these kind of stories, then we end up with teenage pregnancy, okay, where kids are not instructed in terms of how to deal with themselves. For the very small children, they don't pay attention to that part of the stories, they pay attention to the other part. And finally, when they're old enough to realize what it is that they're talking about, they're the age that they should be listening to that anyway. Because a lot of these coyote stories are telling you, this is the consequence of your action. This is what happens to you if you show disrespect, if you don't keep the harmonies, if you break the laws. So you're constantly hearing what's happening, coyote, and all the trouble that he gets into because he doesn't do the sorts of things that he's supposed to do. That he doesn't listen to the old people when they tell him different things that he's supposed to do. And of course, Shiwasha. Long time ago, coyote was traveling along. Now, coyote saw something very strange and mysterious happening. He saw what we call in our language a twati, an Indian doctor. And this Indian doctor, this medicine person, was a willalikyai, a rabbit. And this rabbit was doing something very strange. And the rabbit would sing, ho, ee-yo, ho, ho. And the eyes of the rabbit would float out of his head and sit up on the branch of a tree. And then amazed, coyote watched, and the rabbit said, weenum, which means come here. And sure enough, the eyes of the rabbit floated back down and fell back inside of his eye sockets. And the rabbit could see again. Well, coyote was really impressed, and he ran over to the rabbit, and he said, show me how to do this trick. Teach me how to do this trick. I will learn how to do this trick. The rabbit said, no. And coyote said, please, 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 show me how to do this trick. I'll learn how to do this trick. And the rabbit said, no. And four times, coyote begged and pleaded, and four times the rabbit said no. And finally, the rabbit said, well, look, I'll show you how to do this thing, coyote, but you must never do it more than four times in one day. If you do it more than four times in one day, something terrible will happen to you. And coyote said, no problem, no problem, just show me how to do it. And so the rabbit taught him the medicine song, and coyote practiced, and coyote sang, ho-wee-yo-ho-ho. And sure enough, coyote's eyes shot out of his head and flew up and sat on the branch of a tree. And then coyote said, weenum. And sure enough, his eyes floated back down and fell inside of his eye sockets, and coyote could see again. Well, meantime, rabbit left and went into another legend. And coyote did this a second time. He did it a third time. He did it a fourth time. And then he thought, why am I wasting my time doing this where nobody can admire me and see how wonderful I am? I should go find the closest village of Indian people so they can be really impressed with me. And so he went around and he found the closest village of Indians, and he called them all out and he said, now check this out. That's loosely translated from the Indian. So all the Indian people watched, and coyote sang, ho, ee, yo, ho, ho. And sure enough, coyote's eyes flew out of his head, sat on the branch of a tree, and this really impressed all the Indian people, just as if right now my eyes were to fall out of my head and roll on the ground, you'd be impressed. And coyote said, that's nothing, now check this out. And coyote said, weenum. And nothing happened, the eyes just sat up there. And coyote got scared, and he said, weenum, weenum, come here, come here, come here. And nothing happened, those eyes just stayed put. And all the Indians thought this was pretty funny. They could take a joke, and they went back home. And just about then, a crow was flying by. And that crow looked down and saw those eyes in the branch of a tree and thought, lunch. And the crow flew down and ate the eyes and flew away. And now coyote was blind. He had no eyes. He couldn't see. And so he was having to feel his way around like this. And first of all, he heard bubbles from running water. And so he tried using bubbles for his eyes, but bubbles, they burst, and so they weren't any good. And so he felt around, he found some huckleberries, and he tried using huckleberries for his eyes. But huckleberries are such a dark, dark color that he couldn't see out of them. It was like being out at midnight with no stars out. And so that didn't work, so he threw those huckleberries away. Now he was getting really worried, and he was feeling sorry for himself, so he was walking around saying, Oh, inishnwai, po'uch ini. And inishnwai means, oh, I'm just pitiful. And po'uch ini is a pun. If you spoke our language, you'd be going, that po'uch will loosely translate as blind, but it really means being so careless you don't know watch where you're going. And so in a sense, Kayodu is blind, but also because he'd been careless, he was blind. And so he was saying, oh, inishnwai, po'uch ini. And he was making so much noise that someone heard him. And that first someone was little Lakasyai, little mouse. And mouse said, what's the matter with you, Coyote? How come you yelling around like this? And Coyote said, oh, inishnwai, po'uch ini, got no eyes. And mouse thought about this, and mouse felt sorry for Coyote. And little mouse said, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Coyote. I've got two eyes. I'll share one of my eyes with you. And so Mouse took out one of his eyes and gave it to Coyote. But a mouse is so small it would fit in the palm of my hand, and a coyote is about the size of a small German shepherd. And so when this little mouse eye was given to Coyote and he plopped it into his eye socket, it kind of rolled around inside of his eye like a BB shot. And it was so small it was like looking through a little tiny hole that it hardly let in any light at all. So Coyote could still just barely see out of this little pinpoint, this little tiny hole of light of the mouse eye. And so he was still not that much better off than he was. He still couldn't see very far with it. And so he was still yelling around, oh, inishnwai, po'uch ini. And someone else heard him. And that someone was the buffalo, se'uchlamyai. And the buffalo said, what's the matter with you, Coyote? How come you yelling around like that? And Coyote said, oh, inishnwai, po'uch ini. All I got to see with this is this mouse eye. That it's so little, it's like looking through this tiny little hole, hardly lets in any light at all. And so Uchlamyai, the buffalo, felt sorry for Coyote, and so he thought for a bit, and he said, tell you what I'm going to do, Coyote. I've got two eyes. I'll share one of my eyes with you. And so Buffalo reached up, and he took out one of his eyes and gave it to Coyote. Well, coyotes are about the size of a small German shepherd, and a buffalo is about the size of a Volkswagen. And so when he got this buffalo eye, it was so large, it wouldn't all fit inside of his eye socket, and half of it hung over on his cheek. And it was so huge that it let in twice as much light as Coyote was used to. And Coyote was just blinded by all this light. Everything looked twice as big as it ordinarily did. And so poor Coyote was forced to walk around with these mismatched eyes. And after a while, he had such a headache, he couldn't stand it any longer, so he took out both eyes and he threw them away. And he thought about what he could do when he couldn't think of anything, and so he gave up. Now, when Coyote can't think of what to do, he has to ask his sisters for help. And he has three huckleberry sisters who live in his stomach because they had housing problems in those days, too. And whenever he is in real trouble, he has to ask them for help. And so he called to them and he said, Weenum Weewino, come here, huckleberries. And sure enough, they jumped out of his stomach and landed on the ground. And they said, what is it this time, Coyote? Always bothering us, always asking us what you should do. And every time we tell you what you should do, you say, I knew it all along. That's what I was going to do anyway. Well, we're tired of it, Coyote. This time you can just figure it out for yourself. And Coyote got angry at his sisters. And Coyote has certain powers of his own. And so Coyote started singing. And Coyote sang, ho, 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 hey, ah, hey, oh, ho, 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 hey, ah, hey, oh, ho, 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 hey, ah, hey, ah, hey, ah, hey, oh, ho. And the sky began turning black, and clouds came up. And there was a sound of thunder and the flash of lightning because Coyote was calling forth hail. Now, huckleberries hate hail because it hurts your little leaves and your little branches. And they said, no, no, Coyote, call out the hail. We'll tell you what it is you want to know. We know what it is you want to know anyway. You want to know what to do about your eyes. use flowers for your eyes. And Kylie said, flowers? And they said, yeah, use flowers for your eyes. Now, what they were talking about in Indian, we call coyote's eyes. And it's a special kind of flower that looks like a daisy that grows over in eastern Washington and eastern Oregon. This is what they were talking about. And Coyote said, I knew it all along. That's what I was going to do anyway. And so his sisters became angry and they jumped back inside of his stomach. And meanwhile, Coyote started feeling around trying to find some of these coyote eyes daisies. And after a while, he found some. And he plucked them and he put them inside of his eye sockets, and sure enough, he could see with them. And those flowers were like big lashes on his eyes. And so he was really proud of himself to have this wonderful set of new flower eyes. Now, this kind of daisy does something very special when the sun starts going down. And as Coyote was watching, suddenly his eyes started wilting and they closed up. And so he was blind again. His sisters had tricked him, and he was really angry with them. So he had to throw those wilted flowers away and wait until dawn when the sun came up and they opened again. And then he felt around, he found a fresh pair, and he put them in and he could see again. And he started looking around for someone he could play a trick on. And he had to look for a long time, and it was late in the afternoon when he finally found an Indian woman. And she was coming back from picking berries, and she had a large basket on her back. And he said, oh, Nichalawit, good afternoon. Mishnamwa, how are you? And she looked at this strange-looking person with these big floppy flower eyes. And she said, I'm fine. Nich. And Coyote suddenly said, oh, look over there. Do you see that pheasant? And this is on the plateau area where everything is flat. And she looked around. She said, what bird? What pheasant? And he said, it's the one behind the tree. And this is a plateau where there's nothing tall. It's just all flat. And she said, what tree? And Coyote said, it's a tree behind the mountain. And she said, just a minute, let me get this straight. You say that you can see a bird that's behind a tree that's behind a mountain? And Coyote said, yes, it's because I have these wonderful flower eyes that I can see anything. Why, I can even see what your husband is doing while you're over here working so hard. And she said, gee, I sure wish I had a pair of eyes like that. And he said, you do? Tell you what I'm going to do. You're such a fine person, I'll trade you straight across. You give me your eyes, and I'll give you my wonderful magic flower eyes. And she said, will it hurt? And he said, no, it won't hurt a bit. Just rip your eyes right out and hand them over. And she said, well, if you really think it won't hurt. And she reached up, and she took out her own eyes, and she gave them to Coyote. And Coyote gave her his flower eyes. And so now Coyote had regular eyes again, and she had flower eyes. And she was looking around, and just about then the sun started going down, and her eyes started wilting and closed up. And she became very angry, and she said, you tricked me! You tricked me! Now I know who you are. You're that old stink coyote. Well, I don't want these old things. And she took out the wilted flowers and threw them down. She said, give me my own eyes back. And Coyote became angry with her. And Coyote said, you didn't want these eyes, then you'll have no eyes at all. You'll spend the rest of eternity feeling your way around the way I had to feel my way around. And he clapped his hands. And when he did, she felt herself changing. And she became smaller and smaller and smaller until she became the person we now call Shukshaya. And Shukshaya in English means the snail. And the basket she carried on her back became the shell that the snail still carries. Our stories about Coyote are important because they teach people many different things about how to act and how not to act. Things such as in the beginning of this story about how Coyote didn't really take the right attitude about approaching a holy person like a Twati. That a Twati or medicine person, like the saints in Christian traditions, can do miracles, but I don't think they think of them as being miracles when they do them. It's just natural for them. It's miracles to us because we can't do those sorts of magic things. And Coyote doesn't go to the holy person and say, teach me how to be spiritually developed, teach me how to be a holy person. He says, show me how to do this trick, because he doesn't really understand what it is a sacred person is doing. And so when he loses his physical eyes, Coyote was already spiritually blind. And part of this story is the talking about trying to see with other pet parts of your eyes, with other people's eyes, other ways of understanding, new ways of perceiving. And that's what I hope you're trying to do every time you come to these sessions that I'm presenting, to try to see with other sets of eyes, to see with new ways, to understand in new ways. And part of this is the way that we train our children in the Southwest. That the dancers that I showed you before, particularly the mass dancers, and the only ones I had as illustrations of that were the mudheads, that for the Pueblo and the Hopi children, that these dancers will come, and they're always seen as generous to the children. When the dancers come as the kachinas, they'll give food and toys and presents to the children. The things that you've heard about, perhaps called kachina dolls, are actually traditionally carved as gifts to the children, because the children will then remember what these kachinas look like, because there are over 250 kachinas who represent many different things. Some are squash kachinas, and some are rainbow kachinas, and some are corn kachinas, because it's the idea that everything that lives has a spirit, and everything is living, regardless of whether it's rock or a rainbow or a plant, and so it can be represented in a kachina form. When a child reaches about the age of 9 or 10, they're expected to have their first initiation. And for those of you familiar with Piaget, something very important is happening about the age of 9 or 10 in terms of the difference of a child understanding the universe. And at that time, the child is taken down to the kiva, those chambers that I showed you in the slide, and the dancer is unmasked in front of the children. And this is a great sense of shock and horror. There is a situation that takes place in American, general American society that's associated with Christmas that has a similar experience I don't want to go into because there's some young children here. But that same kind of sense of terrible betrayal, to realize that these beings that you were raised with, to be taught that these are really the ones we talk about in our legends and stories, come to earth again, are really your uncle or your father or your grandfather, is a terrible sense of shock and betrayal for a child. And at that moment, these children are given whips made out of yucca, and they're given permission to whip their parent, their grandfather or their uncle, to get the anger and hostility immediately expressed. And it's only after this sense of betrayal that the child is considered old enough to start training to dance as a kachina himself. And this is something that's very hard to explain to a lot of non-Indian people, because it deals with concepts of transubstantiation, which I understand is something of a touchy subject with Lutherans. The idea that when a dancer dances on one level of reality, that dancer really is just your husband, or just your brother, or your father, or your uncle, or your grandfather. And yet on another level of reality, what we told the children in the beginning, that these really are the kachinas because the dancers have transubstantiated, is also true. But a child has to be old enough to hold both truths in their mind at the same time, to realize that we are just human beings. And yet on another level of reality, we're also sacred people ourselves. That everybody is sacred because we are children of the Creator. That we're made in the image of God. And for that reason, each person is also sacred. And that's why I started this presentation with reading that quote by Coleridge. The idea, be careful of whom you tread upon. Because even though you might despise that individual, this was a soul that was so precious to Christ that he was willing to die for that person. And this is what we also teach with our Native American tradition, in terms of showing respect, in terms of the power within that individual, that this individual is someone very, very sacred. And if you show that much respect to your neighbor, how can you not show that respect to yourself? How can you deny the sacredness and preciousness within you? That Christ not only died in terms of your neighbor, Christ also died for you. How dare you devaluate yourself by not seeing how much ability and talent and power and sacredness is within you, at least within the eyes of Christ? And for that reason, I want to remember these stories. I want to remember these things. I also mentioned during Vespers last night and last evening's class that one of the things we wanted people to do for Vespers this evening is to pick out some object or some design or something that they would take in front of the altar as an offering, as a connection between the creation and you. The idea of you being a part of God's creation, that you offer that up which is special to you. Maybe not the most precious possession you have, but what's appropriate for you at this moment in time, on this day, during this hour. Something that's meaningful for you, whether it's a leaf or a stone, a ring, a poem, a Bible, whatever is important for you to bring up to the altar. And so I wanted to remind you of that, to let you have that opportunity to make that connection between yourself and other people. When you saw so much of the things that we traditionally wear in our religious ceremonies, our activities, our dances, the way that I'm dressed right now, those things all have meanings. Those things all have teachings. And part of it is the idea that we feel a need to decorate, to glorify that which we use because it's being used in a sacred manner. And I wanted to share with you, finally, the conclusion that Madeleine L'Engle writes in her book, Walking on Water, which is available at the bookstore, in terms of what exactly is a Christian artist. And her conclusion is, a Christian artist sees work as being for the glory of God. A Christian artist sees work as being for the glory of God. And as a native person, raised in my own tradition, this is how I think you should see other human beings who are the artwork of the Creator. How can you serve God in your own way, in the glory of God? How can you take the talents and abilities that are part of your very existence and use them for that glorification? Anakushnai. Anakushnai means I'm finished. Thank you.